This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll talk about using DNA to store digital information. But first, up near the Arctic Circle, entombed in Canadian bedrock, researchers say they have dug up the oldest fossil to date, fossilized bacteria, estimated to be between 3.7 billion and 4.2 billion years old. The study is published this week in the journal Nature. But of course, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, so there is some pushback by critics. Sophie Bushwick is here to fill us in on that story and other science headlines from the week. She's senior editor at Popular Science. She joins us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome back, Sophie.
Thanks.
Let's talk. What exactly did the researchers find in this rock? Was it a whole bunch of bacteria that were in there?
So what they specifically found were these filaments of hematite, of oxidized iron, that they think could have been left by these bacteria that processed iron, that oxidized it. The problem is that, you know, when you find a dinosaur fossil, you find bones, and that's pretty clear evidence that an animal was there. When you're looking for evidence of these bacteria, you're really looking for the evidence of their past presence in these types of microscopic formations, which makes it more difficult to prove that something was definitively there.
Just something that was left behind then, and they found the evidence.
Right, exactly.
If it was 4.2 billion years old, a long, long, long time ago, mm-hmm. how would this alter our idea about how life evolved on Earth?
Well, the oceans on Earth only formed about 4.4 billion years ago, so this would really compress the time. This would say life arose way earlier than we thought it would in less friendly conditions for life, which would mean that, well, that it was more resilient than we thought, although we already know life is pretty resilient, but mm-hmm. also that it formed in conjunction with our planet sort of developing.
Now the runner-up until this time, the runner-up for the oldest fossil was just a few months ago, right? How much older is this one than that one?
So that fossil was found in Greenland, and it was, I think, 3.7. They said it would have been 3.7 billion years old. This one is at least 3.77 billion years. And that extra decimal point might sound like it might sound like nothing, but bear in mind that when we're talking billions of years, yeah. that adds up to a pretty big difference.
Yeah. Sooner or later, you're talking big numbers. What kind of evidence will researchers need to dig up now to prove this theory that it was actually bacteria?
Well, I think they'll need to find more of this type of formation dating from the same time period to sort of support it. Although some other researchers who study this type of early life, they've found these types of bacterial formations dating back to 3.3 billion years, I think. They said that these new formations are too large, that there wouldn't have been enough oxygen to sustain bacteria making such large formations back at the time period we're talking about. And so there is a lot of back and forth about whether these are a natural formation or one actually caused by life on Earth.
You know, it reminds me of a discovery on Mars made years ago where they thought they found some rock formations which had sort of other things left over by the bacteria, and they thought, mm-hmm. maybe this is signs of old life, but they could never prove that.
Yeah, either. Yeah. That's the problem when you're looking at such huge timescales. I mean, billions of years, is that the evidence is less definitive.
Yeah, yeah. Let's move on to this uptick in colon cancer in younger age group. It's really not typically seen there, is it?
No. So, and in fact, colon cancer, colorectal cancer in general, rates have been going down since 1975. But when researchers sort of looked at which age groups are getting this cancer, they found that in people under age 50, that it is actually on the rise. And that's both people in their 40s and people in their 20s and 30s.
Among all age groups, of all socioeconomic levels in mm-hmm. general? Do they have any idea why there's such a higher incidence in younger
age groups?
They've
got a few different ideas. The increase in rates of cancer is tracking pretty similarly with increasing rates of obesity, which could be upping people's odds of developing this cancer. Of course, that's not they haven't proven that's a causal link, but it seems like one of a few different potential culprits. Another thing that they're looking into is it could be binge drinking.
Binge drinking?
Yeah, younger people are more likely to drink at those heavy rates. And so that could be contributing. Alcohol can increase your risk of several different kinds of cancer, including colorectal cancer.
Mm-hmm. Well, one question about screenings. Is that having more screenings might lead to more false positive cancer results? Maybe that has something to do with it? People are getting screened more?
You would think that's a possibility. But in fact, people over 40 are getting screened more. People in their 20s and 30s aren't. Yeah. It's not recommended that they get screened.
Yeah, that's so true.
It should. What we should maybe do is have those types of screenings happening more.
Well,
teach people more about the symptoms of these cancers so that they can go get diagnosed sooner.
Yeah. Finally, your last story looks at foodie fads, the science behind foodie fads. What's the latest? What are some of the latest foodie fads?
So a group of cardiologists looked at a bunch of different fads and to see, well, what's the actual scientific evidence for this being helpful? And one of the big things they found is that, sorry, juice fans, but juicing is not good for your heart health. It encourages you to consume more calories, and they are more sugary. You're taking the fiber out of these fruits that you're eating, which means that you can consume more calories without feeling full, and also you're losing out on those health benefits.
Yeah, you want the fiber. I mean, that's the
you
thing.
Do.
When you juice the fruit, the fiber's gone. In fact, they make a little puddle of it at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
But people who are big into food say, no, you don't want to break it all up. You need that fiber to catch some of the bad stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Fiber helps move foods through your system, and it's got proven health benefits like that. And the other thing is that, you know, I wouldn't sit down and eat three giant apples in a row, but I might drink a glass of juice that had that much sugar in it.
Yeah.
So if you're actually eating the fiber, you're going to feel fuller sooner. And the act of chewing actually tells your brain that you're eating. When you're just drinking, your brain isn't likely to tell you, hey, slow down.
Yeah. What about people who are on these cleanses? Did you look into cleansing?
The problem with cleansing is, yeah, the idea you've heard that maybe drinking juice helps you detox.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
No. Your body is a naturally, it cleanses itself, really. You've got organs like the kidneys that help filter out bad stuff out of your body and that you can excrete that as urine. And there's other systems in the body that help you keep it clean. And the problem with juicing is it can cause your blood sugar to spike, which is not something that you want.
Well, the good news about food fads is if you didn't like this one, there'll be another one around tomorrow.
I'm sure there will be.
Thank you, Sophie. Sophie Bushwick is senior editor at Popular Science, and she was here in our CUNY studios. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. As you know, it's been unseasonably warm this week. Maybe it's got you thinking about summer pool season, taking a dip. Well, you might want to think twice about putting a toe in the water or the rest of your body, because thanks to a study published this week, we now have an idea of just how much of that pool water is actually urine. Yeah, that's what I said. How did researchers discover this? Well, you could say it was a pretty sweet bit of chemistry. Lindsay Blackstock, PhD student at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on your show.
How can there be good news about this?
Well, I suppose the good news is that we're able to take this opportunity of this really intense media attention we've gotten to promote public health and good swimming hygiene practices. Because we don't want people to be afraid of swimming, that's for sure.
Well, tell us how this all came about. How do you keep track of how much pee is in the pool?
Absolutely. So first of all, we're not actually measuring urine. We're measuring an artificial sweetener called acesulfame, and acesulfame is unique because it is consumed quite widely among the general public because it's present in a lot of different processed foods and drinks. And it's also very stable. So it moves through your body very quickly and it's not metabolized. So it exits the same way that it goes in. And what's unique about acesulfame is it's excreted 99% in urine. So if we're finding it in swimming pools and hot tubs, that the only logical explanation we can come up with why it's at elevated levels is because people have to be peeing in the pools.
Wow. And do you think this is on the low side? Because if somebody is peeing in the pool and hasn't taken some artificial sweetener in the past 24 hours, they'll be missed, won't they?
Sure. So we always have to keep in mind all the sources of error that can go into these estimations that we make. So the way that we came up with the estimation is we looked at 20 Canadian urine samples, mixed them all together, and got the average that way for how much ACE or acesulfame was in Canadian urine. So absolutely. When we did that calculation, we were doing it based on the average sweetener we found in Canadian urine. That assumption is could be wrong. There could be people who are urinating in the pools that haven't had any of that artificial sweetener, and there could be ones that maybe they're eating a lot of sweetener and they're not urinating. So there's a lot of factors that can play into that.
So how much pee is in the pool?
And again, so what we estimated was the volume of urine that would be required to lead to the concentration of acesulfame in the pool. So we found in one large pool, larger size pool, about one third the size of an Olympic size swimming pool, was 75 liters of urine. And in one half that, which was about 110,000 gallons, was 30 liters of urine. But keep in mind, that doesn't mean that 30 liters of urine is present, because urine can be very difficult to measure in swimming pools and hot tubs because it's broken down quite quickly.
Hmm. So is there any way for me or a layperson to measure that ourselves with a home test kit?
Not at this point, no. But most university chemistry departments or chemistry labs should have the analytical instrumentation to do this type of test. And that's why we proposed it as a strategy to potentially monitor urine input into swimming pools.
So what's to be gained by the study? Instead of just informing us, is there any good stuff to come out?
Well, really, what we want to tell the general public is that we really want to promote swimming. We think it's a great form of exercise. We also want to make sure that we acknowledge all the pool operators and facility operators because they do a wonderful job.
But the bottom line is, don't pee in the pool.
Exactly. Don't pee in the pool. Okay. We don't want to scare people. We don't want to stop disinfecting pools because it's a great way to make sure we don't.
We got to go.
Transmit. Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you for joining us, Lindsay Blackstock, PhD student, University of Alberta. When we come back, we're going to dive into the world of bee intelligence. How smart are bees? They can play soccer. We'll talk to bee experts. You'll want to be here after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A group of researchers from Queen Mary University of London have trained bees to push a ball around the ground. And then when they do that, they receive a sweet treat reward. Researchers reporting in Science noted those soccer-playing bees were displaying something called cognitive flexibility. And it got us wondering, are bees the smartest insect? Numerous studies show just how good they are at telling the difference between things. You know, they're great at navigation, even teaching stuff to other bees. So what does this tell us about the bee brain? And what about bee cognition? Do they actually think? Helping us to dig deeply into what's behind bee intelligence are my guests, Dr. Lars Chitka, professor of sensory and behavioral ecology at Queen Mary University of London. Dr. Felicity Muth.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. Is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Nevada in Reno. And if you have questions about the intelligence of bees, give us a call on number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. So, Lars, are bees the smartest insect?
I don't know, is the honest answer.
They're pretty smart, though.
The reason why a lot is known about bee intelligence is because they come in large numbers, at least if you're talking honeybees and bumblebees, and so it's relatively easier to gain large quantities of data from them. But you find in other insects very remarkable abilities. There are some species of wasps where all members of the colony recognize one another individually by their facial features. There are some solitary wasps that, as opposed to bees who have only one home, have multiple nests at a time and have to remember the locations mm-hmm. of all of them. So there's probably plenty of intelligence in other insects that has been poorly explored.
But you explored the bee, the study. You did the bee study, the soccer bee study that came out last week. What did you learn about the bee behavior in that experiment? And were you surprised at how well the bees did?
Yeah, we were very surprised, especially by one particular twist that I'll come back to in a moment. Now, it's long been known that bees are able to associate rewards with certain aspects of flowers, such as colors and patterns and scents and so on. But in scenarios where the reward isn't that immediate, it wasn't that clear how well they would perform at that. And so in this particular case, the bees had to use a ball as a kind of tool or a token, in the same way that you use perhaps a token to put in a vending machine in order to obtain a sugary sweet bar or something like that. They had to learn to move that ball from a particular destination to a goal, a target destination, in order to obtain a reward. And that alone, I think, was remarkable in that so far we knew that bees would be able to sort of push various things out of their way in order to gain access to a reward, which is sort of similar to what they do in a complex flower like a snapdragon. But in this case, they really had the flexibility to move an object from A to B. Mm-hmm. But what was even more remarkable is the way in which uninformed individuals that had no prior exposure to this task learned it from their sisters. And the remarkable thing was, not only did they copy the right technique and copy the notion of where to place the ball, but these observers actually did something better than what they had seen the skilled bees do. And this is how we did that. We played a little trick on the skilled bees in that there were three balls available, each at a different distance from the goal. And obviously the smart thing to do would be to move the closest ball to its target. But we glued the closest ball and the second closest ball down so that the skilled bee only ever moved the furthest ball to the goal destination. And at the same time as these skilled bees performed that task, we let an uninformed individual that had no idea what to do with that ball into the arena to allow it to observe what that demonstrator, as we call it, did with the ball. And once the ball was in the target destination, they always both got a sugary reward. And after doing that three times, we put the previously naive individual on the spot and let it alone into the experimental setup without the presence of a skilled demonstrator. And now this observer had a choice between stupidly aping, so to speak, what they had seen the demonstrator do, that is, pick the furthest ball and move that to the target. Alternatively, they could copy the technique and do the right thing with the ball and pick the closest one. And the latter is what they did. So rather than just imitating, if you wish, what these naive bees had seen the demonstrator do, that is, move the furthest ball, The previously naive individuals now did the clever thing. They did the right thing with the ball and they picked the closest ball to the target and moved it there.
Felicity, does this mean that bees are intelligent, do you think?
Well, I think that one of the problems is we use this word intelligence, but a word in itself, it doesn't actually mean that much, because the word intelligence probably means something different to every person. And as humans, we tend to think of intelligence in very human terms. But of course, every animal's cognition is just evolved to deal with the situation that the animal has to deal with. So how animals think reflects what they need to think about in their environments. So I think what this shows here is a kind of very specific form of cognition that bees use in their natural environment.
Mm-hmm. And why, Felicity, do we know so much about bee behavior? Why would we study them so much over the other insects?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think that we've had a kind of fascination with bees for a really long time. So the very first learning experiment with bees was actually done around 100 years ago. And the person who did that experiment, Carl von Frisch, won the Nobel Prize for his findings. So I think that bees, because of the relationship we have with bees, for example, honeybees, we're kind of naturally drawn to them. But also they work really well in a lab environment. They're kind of the best subjects you could have, because they're endlessly motivated to partake in experiments. And they have all these interesting cognitive abilities that makes them really rewarding to work with.
Mm-hmm. Lars, tell me about the bee brain. Does the bee's brain look impressive because it can do all these things?
Well, it looks impressive because it can do all these things, but it also looks impressive if you look inside. So we are impressed, of course, by the tremendous diversity of both innate as well as learned behavioral routines that a bee's brain can produce. And I guess all too often people will assume that because a bee's brain is little, which it undoubtedly is, it's no larger than perhaps a pinhead, that it might therefore be simple or not complex. But of course, once you actually examine its structure, granted it has only about a million nerve cells, but each individual one of them might be as complex in its structure as a fully grown oak tree. And of each of these million cells, a single one of these nerve cells might make contact with perhaps 10,000 or 100,000 other cells in that same brain. So it's a long way from being a simple brain, but perhaps it's simpler than obviously a human brain with its 85 billion neurons. And so therefore we're hoping that we can use bees as a shortcut to understand integrative brain function and multitasking.
It's fascinating, the structure of the bee brain. Felicity, I know that you study animal cognition, and so I'm asking you, how do bees stack up against other animals? Can you measure the intelligence against, let's say, against a dog or something like that?
Well, I think that what we try and do as animal cognition scientists is not necessarily look at cognition or intelligence overall, but rather pick out one particular cognitive ability. And what I really like about the recent study that Dr. Chitka had out and a handful of studies he's had out recently is that they show these seemingly complex behaviors that bees have, but because of the ease of working with bees, we can actually get at the mechanism underlying these behaviors. And so this is useful if we want to compare it to behaviors in other animals, for example, dogs or chimpanzees or even humans, because they're showing similar behavior, but actually it's a system where we can get at what might be the mechanism underlying this behavior.
Here's a tweet in from Angela who asks, did you use a controlled color arrangement for the bulbs, like similar or dissimilar to flowers, Lars?
That's a good question. So the balls in the training were all yellow, and the background on which they are presented is blue. So in that sense, these are colors that will often be found at natural flowers. But of course, the task at hand was very different from what bees do at natural flowers. So in the sense that you can perhaps explore animal intelligence to the effect that it actually, the cognitive performances depart from what you see in natural behavior. Bees are obviously very good at learning colors. In fact, much better or faster at doing that than pretty much any other animal, human infants included. And the reason is because they're natural born color choosers. Colors have natural meaning to bees, whereas they don't to cats, obviously, for example. So in that sense, the task was perhaps facilitated by as far as it is from a bee's natural task, but it might have been facilitated by the colors we chose. But it was interesting to observe that the bees actually didn't stick narrowly to the colors that they had encountered or experienced during training, because if, for example, after this demonstration phase by a skilled demonstrator, we replaced the yellow balls with a black one, which is really not what you typically find in flowers, certainly not a black movable item, the observer bees were still able to solve the task and even solve it when they were faced with this three-way choice of which ball to move. So they disentangled their strategy from the particular color that they had encountered during training.
What kind of bees were these?
These are bumblebees of a European species, Bombus terrestris.
Would we then extrapolate to all bees the same kind of abilities, or do you need to test each one?
I think we may have to test other ones on a case-to-case basis, but my guess is that if you were tested on any other common bumblebee species, you will find similar affordances.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Daniel in Statesboro, Georgia. Hi, Daniel.
How you doing, Iroh?
Hey there. Go ahead.
I have a question. My at my property, we have a large bee that comes back at the same identical location year after year. And if we go out there and get close to it, it doesn't attack us. It just kind of looks at us. It runs off every other flying thing in the air and just comes back year after year. I'm just wondering how old do these bees get? I just can't imagine it's the same bee. It's probably been 8-10 years. And do they pass their knowledge on to be able to keep doing this behavior?
Interesting question. Let me get an answer for you. Thanks for calling. Lars, what do you think?
I suspect that in that case, it's not a social bee, but a solitary bee. And it's likely that what you're seeing from one year to the next are sequential generations of the same species of bee. But that's very hard to tell without actually seeing what kind of bee it is.
But the bees actually...
But it's quite possible...
I'm sorry, I understand, though, that bees can recognize faces, right? I mean, would they know? If you had the same bee coming back, would it be able to know it was you?
So we have trained bees to recognize black and white images of human faces. Now, that doesn't mean that their face recognition is as elaborate as ours. That is, that they could necessarily recognize a human face under natural conditions. So when beekeepers ask, will my bees recognize me? Maybe, maybe not. So I think the task of recognizing a moving face that has to be recognized from all kinds of angles and in different lighting conditions is probably more complex.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday for PRI, Public Radio International. The delay is a killer. let me. I have a few minutes left. Lars, if you were to do more research, what more do you need to know? What would you like to know? If they gave you a blank check to study bees, what would you use it for?
Yeah. So I mean, one of the things that we are extremely curious about, which you'd already mentioned, is how can such a little brain juggle so many tasks and learn so many things and store so much information. And for that, we're working with a number of very skilled modelers to build as realistic as possible models of the bee brain to explore how, with minimal circuitry, you can get so much done. And that's something that we're trying to explore over the next few years.
Felicity, does studying bee intelligence tell us anything about the causes of colony collapse or what we might do about that?
Yeah, I think studying bee intelligence or cognition is really useful for informing the decline that we've had in bees, because understanding cognition is kind of what we would call basic research. So it doesn't have an obvious application, but if we want to understand how things like pesticides and habitat loss are affecting bees, then we need to have a baseline of how they're behaving under natural conditions without those environmental perturbations. So I'd say that it's really important in informing how we think about the declines that we've had in bees.
Mm-hmm. Is there any reason why you'd want to train bees, Lars, to do any other things? I mean, anything useful? And by training a few, teach the rest of the colony?
It depends on what you have in mind by anything useful. I think one reason why we study bees, and we actually have quite a bit of funding from an engineering research council at the moment because of the obvious question of how can you navigate reliably over long distance with essentially 0% errors by using such a tiny microcomputer as a bee has. So imagine you could steer a jumbo jet from start to finish with a computer as large as a bee brain. And yet the tasks, in essence, are by and large the same. You need to get an object to fly through three-dimensional space and get it reliably onto the ground and off the ground and so on. And so, of course, it is there is potentially quite a bit of applied value in studying how they process information.
Dr. Lars Chitka, Professor of Sensory and Behavioral Ecology at Queen Mary University in London. Dr. Felicity Muth, Postdoctoral Fellow, University of Nevada in Reno. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
After taking a break, we're going to talk about watching movies or playing video games, all stored on DNA. DNA, using it to store stuff. It's got a lot of storage capacity. We'll talk about it right after this. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. DNA. It's the blueprint for life, but it's also a string of letters, the A's, the C's, the G's, and the T's, not unlike the zeros and ones of the binary code we use to store data. And this similarity has led scientists to speculate that perhaps someday we could use DNA itself to store data more efficiently than silicon. Even better, it would last longer, avoid corruption problems, and never go the way of the VHS tape or the floppy disk. And this is not a new concept. Researchers have been working on it for years and have successfully stored and retrieved everything from Shakespearean sonnets to photos to a music video from the band OK Go. And one of my guests has even stored an entire computer operating system in DNA. You can play Minesweeper off the code his team retrieved when they sequenced it again. In 2013, we talked to a researcher who said all the knowledge of humankind written in DNA could fit in the back of a station wagon. So how soon are we actually going to archive all of that? When can you play Minesweeper off a DNA operating system? That's what we're going to be talking about today. If you want to join us, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guests. Yaniv Ehrlich, Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Computational Biology at Columbia University in New York. He's a core member at the New York Genome Center. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Olgica Milenkovic is Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. You're welcome. Sri Kosuri is Assistant Professor of Biochemistry at UCLA in Los Angeles. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having us on.
Yaniv, you have a vial of DNA sitting in front of you, and what is stored on this tiny little bit of it?
So in this tiny little bit of DNA, we have here a French movie called The Arrival of a Train. It's a French movie that was filmed in around 1885, so over 100 years ago, and now it's on DNA. We have a computer operating system. We have an Amazon gift card of $50. We have a manuscript, one of the most influential manuscripts in information theory. And we also put the Pioneer plaque that we sent to space. So we put the figure over there and a computer virus on DNA.
All in that tiny little, looks like the pinhead, the head of a pin.
Exactly, yeah.
Why is the gift card in there?
So the gift card is a funny thing. We wanted to encourage someone to reproduce our study. So, in fact, I contacted one of my Twitter followers that was really interested in what we are doing. And I told him that, you know, you can download the sequencing data from this European archive that we store the data. Here is the code. And if you can recover the files, you can have the $50 and just purchase something nice for you. So he did this operation, was able to get the file, and got a book about machine learning. We are all geeks, so yeah.
You're in good company.
Yeah.
Sri, we're talking about DNA as if putting data on it were an everyday thing, right? But this is sort of a gee whiz story even a year ago. How do you get the encoding on DNA?
Well, the encoding, when we did it many years ago in a very dumb way, was essentially just ones or zeros replaced T's or C's. And G's or A's, so it was a very redundant code that wasn't super dense when we did it just as a kind of proof of concept. What Yaniv has done in this new work is really quite nice, which DNA has a lot of negative sides to it, so when we synthesize our sequence DNA, we have all sorts of dropouts or certain sequences are hard to read or write. And so what Yaniv's code, which he borrowed from computer science and these fountain codes, are basically taken from body transmission algorithms that are meant to convey information over noisy communication lines, and used it to encode DNA, encode this information in DNA. And what that allowed him to do is really bring to scale the types of ideas that have been around for, even before we were working on it, decades now, into something that seems pretty reliable in, mm-hmm. in this newest work.
Let me, let me ask you, why? Why would you want to put, how reliable is DNA? Why put all your photos on it? What are the benefits?
So if you think of DNA as a media, and my background is coding theory, and basically coding theorists have been magnetic, optical, racetrack memories for a very long time. And the interest is really to allow reliable writing, reliable reading of the information. And storing in DNA has many benefits because DNA offers exceptional densities, as we all know, but it's also a naturally robust media that can survive for long periods of time. The issues and the bottlenecks in terms of reliability come from the process of writing, which is basically synthesizing the DNA strings, and reading, which is some form of sequencing. And that's where the interesting action, at least in coding theory, happens, because the readout systems used for DNA storage systems are very different from what we have seen in classical recorders. The types of errors, the types of patterns that are error-prone when recorded are nothing like we've seen before, and they require very new approaches in coding theory, which is why I'm very excited about this mm-hmm. field.
Mm-hmm. Yaniv, is it error-free, the recording, or how?
So it's not error-free. We have some errors in the synthesis and the sequencing, as Olgitza said, but our method allows us to kind of like go and to correct for these errors, and it's highly robust. For instance, we showed that we can, every time we read the DNA, we consume some amount of material. Now, for instance, my daughter, she loves to hear Frozen. So every day we hear maybe 5 times the song of Frozen. So after a week, if Frozen was encoded on DNA, we would run out of material at all. So using our technique, we show that we can copy the DNA, copy the copy, and so on 9 times. And we can retrieve, although we introduce more errors, we can retrieve and correct these errors and get a file that is fully accurate. We can watch this movie, we can play Minesweeper on the operating system, so it's fully robust.
But it's not as fast yet as, I mean, as a hard drive, as writing and reading, that kind of stuff.
Much slower than a hard drive, but copying exact copies of the data is extremely fast because it's an enzymatic reaction.
Olgika, I understand that you're working on making DNA not just readable, but random access and rewritable, like a hard drive, right?
So this is a big and interesting project that I've been dreaming of the last few years about. And as I mentioned, given the background of my group, which has been working in data storage for over 20 years now, we realized that there is so much that can be done with this media. And as you mentioned, random access is one thing. Another thing we did as well is make it portable. Because as people that are really related to the storage industry, we know that once you have the data stored, you also need to read it in a very delay-tolerant manner, which we are not very close to doing right now. But you also want to have your readout system handy. You don't want to carry big sequencing devices that cost anywhere from $500,000 to even more with you. So our recent work has focused on making systems that are portable, and we switched to using nanopore sequencing devices for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. A lot of geeky folks like us are calling in. Let's go to Eric in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Ira. I'm curious, how vulnerable is this data to corruption? Like, could a DNA drive mutate, and what would happen to the data if it did?
Could it mutate? Now we're into wow, Yaniv, is it going to mutate? Thank you for the question.
That's great question. Thank you so much. So we showed, in fact, this copying process mutates the DNA quite a lot. It introduces many, many errors. But we have this type of error-correcting codes of redundancy that allows us to complete back the information. I will give you an analogy. The way that we encode the data is not kind of like we just transmit the file. we first organize the file as if it was a Sudoku puzzle. And then what we show, but it's a very simple Sudoku puzzle, like a kid's version. And we just send many, many hints. Every DNA molecule is a hint about the file. Now, think that I will give you a DNA a Sudoku puzzle for kids, and I'm going to be mean. I'm going to erase some of the cells. Probably you can still go and complete the Sudoku puzzle, although I was mean and didn't give you the entire puzzle. This is the same way that it works here. Although not all the DNA molecules are going to make it, some of them are erroneous, we can still solve the puzzle and get back the file.
Mm-hmm. Sri, you're a biochemist. Do you worry about things mutating, you know, like DNA?
Well, I think Yaniv is talking about the physical nature of DNA. I think sometimes people think about, oh, well, this is DNA and it could turn into a real-life virus. I think we've talked about things like that in the past, but all the storage mechanisms we've been talking about thus far are outside of a living organism. So getting DNA back in to an organism is extremely difficult, and so the safety profiles of such a thing is, A, your likeliness that you actually encode something living is little to none, but even then, getting it inside of the entire machinery of the cell is also extremely unlikely. So I think there's very little thought that there would be danger there, especially since the amount of DNA or the size of these DNA molecules are quite short.
Let's go to Washington. Thanks for that answer. Let's go to Washington. Benjamin, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I was curious as to whether you could use this technique with any other chemical structure other than biologically living DNA. Could you, you know, design something that's sort of a, for lack of a better word, silicon-based, that would still use this same molecular encoding strategy?
I think that Olgisa did some work. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sri?
So,
yeah.
Oh, please go ahead, Sri, if you want to say.
Oh, I think one point to make is that this is a biological polymer, and this is just a very specific version of information storage inside of a polymer. So one point could be you could use any other polymer, the one that might be easier to read and write, for instance. But I think one advantage is, there's a couple of advantages of DNA, one being that there exists a wealth of enzymes and natural things that have evolved that make our lives a lot easier. For example, the ability to make copies from individual molecules incredibly easy through the use of polymerases that have evolved for billions of years. So if we use a different polymer, it would be nice to have the tools to be able to deal with things like that.
Let me just interrupt because I have to be rude here. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Okay, Olgitsa, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah, so what I wanted to say to the caller is that there are a lot of endeavors right now that try to use different polymers, synthetic polymers.
Oh, her line is dropped out.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. A group in France is using synthetic polymers, which have the big advantage of being very easy and cheap to synthesize, which is not the case with DNA. But as Sri pointed out, the fact that it's a synthetic polymer really makes copying the part of the system that Yaniv is efficiently using with DNA. Copying is not very efficient with a synthetic polymer.
Go ahead. So we're sort of using a CRISPR then to edit the DNA? Is that one of the tools we might use?
Potentially. But it's still pretty expensive and not very precise for...
How do all of you see using DNA in the long run? Is it going to be on a thumb drive, on a server farm, Yaniv? What do you think so far?
So I think the way that we'll use DNA is that most users will not even know that they are using DNA as their storage media. We think about something like a cloud service where you want to store some files for a very long amount of time, very cheaply. And there will be a service that will offer a great price for you, but you will not know that it uses DNA. But this service can now take all the benefits of DNA, the compactness of this molecule and do all the operation of sequencing, synthesizing, and taking care rather than us actually carrying DNA with us around the city.
And Sri, how are we going to make this cheaper and make it practical to use?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the million-dollar question. Right now, we're on order a million-fold too expensive on the synthesis side. And we have seen drops that are very large in biology, and there are ways to think about getting to such drops, but, you know, that's a long way from here to there, getting to about a million-fold drop in cost.
Well, Geeta, what is your vision for the future look like?
I believe that it's going to be a long road ahead. I agree with Sri. Ideally, I would like to see a DNA flash memory, because I think that is the DNA analog of a flash memory, because that would be the first thing we could hope for, and the technology is very close to allowing us to do something like that, except for the cost. And I think I agree with Sri again that we need to drive the cost of synthesis and the delay of sequencing down in order to make this plausible.
Let me get one quick call in from Amy in Manhattan. Hi, Amy.
Oh. Hi. I was wondering, do we need to worry about this code in DNA being hacked?
Ah.
And would the self-correcting mechanism make that less likely?
Yaniv, can you hack it?
So you cannot really hack it. It's not a living organism. It's like thinking about your coffee in the morning, that you drink the milk and there is DNA of cow, and somehow this DNA is taking over you. It's just a molecule that you cannot really hack it, or it's not a living organism. So, yeah, I don't think there is any risk over here.
Okay, that's about all. This is quite fascinating. We'll have to revisit this. Yaniv Ehrlich is Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Computational Biology at Columbia University in New York. Olgica Milankovic is Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Sri Kosuri is Assistant Professor of Biochemistry at UCLA in Los Angeles. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And one last thing before we go, to all our fans in Florida, we are coming your way. Mark the calendar Tuesday, March 28th at the Bob Carr Theater in Orlando. We'll talk about bionic arms and robots that will mine the moon, a whole lot of other geeky futuristic stuff. Join us one night only in Orlando. Tickets are going fast. You can get information at sciencefriday.com/Orlando. sciencefriday.com/Orlando. Tuesday, March 28th, Bob Carr Theater in Orlando. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flato in New York.